The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Is that? No? How's that? Is that better? Okay. Good evening. Nice to be here. Nice to be back. I can't hear my... Oh, maybe that's better. Let me know if that's too... Sometimes my voice tends to drop, so... Higher? Louder? Okay, I'll try. I don't know if that's... I just have a... Oh, maybe that's better. I have a brief announcement before I start, which is that next week, 1 week from tonight, the speaker will be a teacher named Dhamma Ruan, who is a wonderful... Dharma teacher from Sri Lanka who's visiting and who's teaching at Spirit Rock right now. And I know he's teaching next week because I'm driving him down. But he's great. And he's he is in his mid-40s, but he's kind of a living link to this tradition in Asia for a number of reasons. You know, he's from Sri Lanka and... Sri Lanka is one of the Southeast Asian countries that has been kind of holding the lineage, you know, this unbroken lineage from the time of the Buddha. I think maybe because it's so isolated geographically or something. So, and just one other little fun fact about Dhamma Ruan is that when he was a boy, he spontaneously chanted these... Pali chants, and he was recorded doing this, and they turned out to be these very, very ancient chants and ancient melodies that only a few monks in the whole country knew about. So it's quite interesting in his whole story of that, and his chanting is beautiful, and his talks are beautiful. So anyway, so that's next Monday. This Monday you have me. Very happy to be here. I was in Japan for the last 8 or 9 months, having my wife is Japanese, and we had our second child in Japan. So, and then recently came back. So it's very nice to be back. And as Jim mentioned, I'm in the teacher training program at Spirit Rock. Which is one of the, this is a big Vipassana meditation center up in Marin. And Gil is training me as a teacher, and so I feel very lucky to have that opportunity. And so one of the things that I've been doing recently is just thinking about what it means to teach, you know, not specifically Dharma, but not only Dharma. And I came across this quote or this saying, which is, the best way to learn is to do. The worst way to teach is to talk. So, somewhat added to my ambivalence about giving Dharma talks. And, but one of the things I appreciate about IMC in this place is we learn by doing, you know. It's like, I remember the first time I came here when this group was meeting in Palo Alto, and you know, I walked in just like, you know, you did. I don't know if it's anyone who's here for the first time, but I walked in, and you know, everyone was sitting quietly, and you know, looked like they were just waiting for something. So I just sat down and just was waiting. And waiting. And then, you know, at some point I realized, you know, oh, you know, it's already started. But this is, you know. So in a way, that's one of the beautiful things about this practice, that whether it's your first time coming here, or your first time meditating, or if you've been meditating for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, the practice is basically the same. You know, it's like we come in, we sit down, and kind of like the way the building is, you know, it's like we flung open the doors and the windows, you know, and just let everything in. And, you know, this kind of immersion in the flow of our experience. And so this to me is learning by doing. And so in a way it's like, even though there's usually a teacher or something, this is not something that can be taught. Or maybe a better way to say it is, we teach ourselves. You know, whereas when we let ourselves just immerse in our experience, our life itself becomes the teacher. You know, our experience becomes the teacher. And we let that teach us, and we let that change us. So in a way, slightly self-serving explanation, because it takes the pressure off of the teacher. Because, you know, so then I ask myself, what is the role of the teacher? And I think it's simply to encourage us to keep coming back, to keep practicing, to keep being willing to open to our experience, to keep being willing to be with what's happening for us. There's one story of Suzuki Roshi, who was the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, which is a place where I've practiced some, and Gil has practiced, and Gil is a teacher there as well. And a student asked Suzuki Roshi, what's the difference between you and me? And Suzuki Roshi said, I have students and you don't. So, yeah, you're right. So we teach ourselves, or life becomes the teacher. And that said, it can be very helpful to be offered some picture of practice, some picture of what practice looks like, and some kind of tools, concepts, tools, ways of understanding our experience that can help this path unfold. And we hear so much about mindfulness. Mindfulness now is, you know, quite a buzzword, and it's in the culture, and it's great. I think it's great. I actually came to Buddhist mindfulness meditation through the program, which some of you have probably heard of, which is called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, which was a book that I read when I was a college student. I really liked it. And it had nothing, I mean, it didn't mention Buddhism at all. But it's helped so many people, and there are many, many programs like that, and many people who have been helped by that. I think one of the special things about IMC, or one of the things that maybe differentiates us or something, is that is how we contextualize mindfulness. Whereas, you know, this kind of a way of seeing mindfulness as part of, it's not only a skill that we can develop, which is a very useful skill, but as part of a path of development, of kind of spiritual development, spiritual maturation. You know, that, and so the idea is that this is a path that leads somewhere. It's, you know, there are many different ways of talking about what the path is, or where it leads. It's something about going beyond this small limited self. You know, something about going beyond the world according to me, you know, my ideas, my preferences, my thoughts, my problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so we can say this leads to something like maturity, a completeness, wholeness. Some people see it in more in the terms of transcendence. Suzuki Roshi talked about big mind, big self. And one of the things I've often heard Gil say is that mindfulness can exist without Buddhism, but Buddhism can't exist without mindfulness. You know, mindfulness is like the foundation. Mindfulness is the factor that has the power to bring all the other mental factors and emotional factors up and in line and in balance to get us going on this path. So the Buddha talked about this path in a number of ways, and one way was that mindfulness is grouped or taught together with a few other mental factors, a few other capacities we have, a few other potentials or forces in the mind, which when these capacities are developed and are in balance, then our practice can really deepen. And so these are sometimes called the five faculties. And so they're faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And the word in Pali for these five capacities we have is indriya, which is derived from the Vedic god Indra, who is said to be in the pantheon of Indian gods. Indra was the ruler of the gods, you know, the controller of even the gods. So it's quite interesting, you know, beautiful that these qualities that the Buddha said are to be the most important to be developed are called indriyas. It's like, you know, so sometimes they're called the controlling faculties. Instead of seeing, you know, the God as projected out there, it's like these are within us, and we have the ability to develop these. This is what Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is one of our great scholars and monks, has to say about these five faculties. The faculties are active powers which coordinate our natural energies, directing them toward the achievement of an inward harmony and balance essential to our true happiness and peace. So, one of the ways I think about it is it's like if the mind and the heart is like a garden, you know, so we have this soil. And if we don't really do anything with it, it often has a tendency to just, you know, go to seed, or there's just weeds, and, you know, I mean, it's this rich soil and it has this wonderful potential, but we need to cultivate it. And over, the Buddha's teaching has this flavor of the mind and the heart is something that we shape, we cultivate, we develop. Train, shape, guide. And that in turn will be able to nourish us, nourish others. So these five faculties: faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. One thing to say about them is that these qualities or these dispositions are said to be innate in us. You know, so it's not something that we need to create. It's not like, you know, we actually already have faith. And so, and we already have effort. We already make effort in every moment. But the question is, what do we have faith in? You know, what are we making effort towards? I think I'll speak for myself, and you know, in here, in just in saying that I notice for myself that when I think about it this way, what I often have faith in is, without consciously trying, but what I often have faith in is, you know, just implicitly, my own fears, the doubts, you know, my thinking, basically. Or desires. We have faith in our desires. You know, we think our desires will satisfy us. You know, what do we make effort towards? We tend to make effort towards things we like. Another word for effort sometimes that's used is energy. You know, and I notice for myself, it's like, I definitely have more energy for the things I like than the things I don't like. One of the things I love doing is going to check the, we don't get our mail at our house and get it somewhere else. I love going to check the mail. You know, I just notice when I think about going to check the mail, I have all this energy doing that. You know, so what do we have energy for? What do we have effort for? I think in this culture, it can often be towards, you know, money or self-image or, you know, all the normal human things. Mindfulness is another capacity we have. You know, we would be, you know, hit by a car if we didn't have mindfulness. We're mindful when we cross the street. Concentration. You know, concentration, the Pali word is samadhi. One of the things that I always enjoy doing is when I'm at the movies, and I haven't been to the movies that often because, you know, having little kids, it's, nobody wants you to bring a little baby to the movies. but when I would go to the movies, I always find it fascinating to look around, you know, in the middle of the movie, to look around at everybody, because everyone is so absorbed, you know. And just, you know, everyone's face is kind of, you know, hanging on the... And it's really, it feels like that. It's like you can get absorbed into the story, just completely merged, you know, and this is the quality of samadhi. So our minds have this capacity. And then wisdom. Wisdom is sometimes called, sometimes translated as discernment. And it's this quality of knowing what's skillful, you know, knowing what's useful. And this is something we use all the time, just in our ordinary life when we're driving. Is it skillful to speed up, to slow down, to look around, to check for the, you know, highway patrol? Or, so we're always using the faculty of wisdom. And so one question is, how can we apply these five qualities of mind, these five faculties, to meditation practice itself? You know, is there a way that knowing about these can somehow make our practice, make our mindfulness practice become more alive? So I'll just go through each of them and just say a little bit about them. Faith. So the first of these is faith, and the Pali word is sada. Sometimes this is translated as confidence. The word in our culture, the word faith, can be a little bit loaded, because different religious traditions have different ways of using the word faith. I happen to like the word faith, but I like confidence, trust, conviction. In Buddhism, this is considered a heart quality. You know, so when you have faith in something, it's something that you put your heart on, something that you put your heart upon. This is the quality that gets us to do something, that gets us to do anything. You know, we have to have some, like, you know, it's coming here, for example. You know, under this definition of faith, everyone in here has some degree of faith in, you know, something about the value, the worthwhileness of doing a practice like this. So this is sort of the impetus to do something. And in Buddhism, it's said that two conditions are necessary for the quality of faith in the Dharma, for the quality of confidence in the Dharma to arise. The first condition is an encounter with suffering, an encounter, you know, some awareness that, you know, I have stress, I have suffering. The second condition is some encounter with the teaching of the Dharma. So it's like, you know, there's suffering and there's some possibility of being free from that suffering. So having these two, you know, the meeting of suffering is what is the conditioning factor for faith to arise. And one of my favorite stories about faith is was one of my Japanese teacher's teacher was one of the most famous Zen masters in Japan, who's since passed away. But his name was Yamada Mumon Roshi. And he would tell this story. My Japanese teacher is telling this story of meeting his teacher, who was Yamada Mumon Roshi. And he was on a bus in Kyoto, and he saw this older man just sitting there reading the newspaper. But there was something about him, something about how he was, the quality of his being, you know, that just captivated my teacher, and he was just entranced with this person, was watching him, and, you know, the guy was just sitting there reading the newspaper, and then eventually he got to his stop and he got off the bus, and so my teacher, who was 18 years old at the time, followed him and just followed him where he walked, and he walked to a temple and he walked through the gates of the temple, and then my teacher followed him, and, you know, and he kind of talked to him or whatever, or became his student. And so there was something in him that aroused this quality of faith. So it could be with some encounter with a teacher, or it could be an encounter, you know, all these stories of people seeing the Buddha. And there was something about his radiance that inspired them. So, you know, and so this idea is kind of like, what do we have faith in? And when our faith in the Dharma, in this practice, is awakened, or is aroused, this is what motivates and inspires us to make effort, which is the second faculty, to rouse the energy that's needed, you know, to do anything, to learn any skill, to learn anything. We need to apply effort. And one of the interesting things about meditation is the kind of effort we make, the quality of the effort, is very important. It's almost inseparable from the practice, from the meditation. It's like, you know, one of the ways that Dharma practice is talked about is like the path is not different from the goal. You know, usually we talk about there's a path and it leads to a goal. But with Dharma practice, it's very interesting because there's a way of understanding it where the path and the goal are not separate. You know, so it's like if you want to be, if you want peace, practice peacefulness. You know, practice being peaceful. And so how we make effort is so interesting in meditation because clearly effort is important. Yet, it's so easy to fall into a kind of over-efforting. And some of us have a tendency one way or the other, it could also depend on, it just depends on the time. And this is where the wisdom factor actually comes in. What's needed now? Am I sleepy? Am I tired? Am I bored? Do I need to open my eyes or stand up or take some deep breaths and make some more effort? You know, really clearly start counting my breaths or doing something. Or am I getting very tight? Is there over-efforting? Is there a lot of me in this effort that I have to get something, I have to get concentrated? Then relaxing the effort. So what I would say in meditation, we're always calibrating our effort. And just to kind of, as I sit, every few minutes, it's almost like turning the mind around and seeing, what's needed now. One of the great feedback in meditation for this is the posture, is the body, Anytime there's tension anywhere in the body can be some sign that there's some holding on, that there's something that can be let go of. So we want to find in a way the sweet spot between being tight, intense, and rigid versus collapsing. You know you're dreaming when the chin kind of just up there and just we'll fall over, and so we're constantly checking the posture and coming back and seeing how is the effort, how is the energy. Does that make sense? I mean, is that so the posture can kind of be this laboratory. It's just a constant feedback loop. One of my Zen teachers likes to say, instead of try harder, try softer. We're so used to this, try harder, or, there must be, and so what is it to try softer? Softly. So faith is what inspires us, motivates us to make effort. And that effort itself is directed towards being mindful, being more mindful. That's the third faculty. We talk about mindfulness so much. I like to think about it as mindfulness is simply knowing what you're doing. It's this knowing quality of the mind, clear awareness. Knowing what you're doing when you're doing it. The Buddha talks about mindfulness as like the overseer of all these other faculties. It's sort of the watchman or the watch woman, you know, that keeps these faculties in balance. And so the mindfulness itself is very interesting because it's not at all difficult to be mindful. Like, you know, how much effort did it take to notice the bell, to be mindful of the bell? You know, it's nothing. It just totally arises effortlessly. So being mindful is not difficult, but remembering to be mindful continuously, moment to moment to moment, is what's difficult. To stay mindful continuously is where we need training. And so usually what happens is we cut out. You know, we're here, and then we're gone. You know, thinking about the past or the future or wondering about something. You know, and then, oh, yeah, and then we come back. And then we're gone. And then we come back. You know, so sometimes that's called the stop-and-go mindfulness. You know, if you've ever been a passenger when someone's driving, like, you know, that, you know how you kind of get a little nauseous or something. You know, but this is the way our minds are. You know, the untrained mind is like that. We have this intention to be here, but, you know, the forces in the mind, preoccupation, take us away, and then we come back. You know, so the training is continually with, you know, without judgment, without any criticism, without totally neutrally, we just come back. Over and over again, we come back. And eventually, at some point, the mind can stay. You know, it's like training a puppy, and the puppy's going this way, and the puppy's going this way, and that way. You know, you walk the puppy over and over again, and at some point the puppy learns, and the puppy just stays. It's like, oh, puppy's staying. You know, that's interesting. And because this quality of being present is so fundamental in life, you know, and all the best things in life can only be enjoyed if we're present to enjoy them. This training in mindfulness, this training in coming back, transfers over into all these other aspects of our life. So we're more present and we're more available for the people we care about, for the things we want to do. You know, as I mentioned, we have this, you know, we have a 2.5-year-old daughter and a baby. She's 4 months. And one of the things, and she's so mellow that, you know, we can just kind of leave her somewhere in the bouncy chair. She just smile and look, and, you know. And, but if I make eye contact with her and I really am there and really see her, she just lights up. I mean, it's quite amazing. It's like the power of being present for another person is just this beautiful thing, and it's, you know, it's being reminded of that. So when moments of mindfulness are strung together, you know, moment to moment to moment, we're not cutting out, we're not going away, we're just here, moment to moment to moment, in a continuous way, that's called samadhi. That's called concentration. You know, concentration is not something other than continuous mindfulness. You know, so that's the reason, you know, you can't really do concentration. You know, the more continuously we're mindful, the more this power, this faculty of samadhi develops. One of my favorite analogies is if you have a big pot of, if you want to make pasta and you have a big pot of water, and, you know, you turn on the flame to get it going. But then you remember, oh, I've got to chop up the, you know, the onions and the garlic. Okay, so you turn off the flame and you go over and you start chopping, you know, and then you come back. So, oh, wait, you know, I have to heat up the fire. So you turn it back on again. And you're like, oh, I have to, you know, get the tomatoes. So you go, turn it off and you go to the, you know, the water is never going to boil, right? Because you keep turning it off. So this is like, you know, the continuous mindfulness is that steady flame. And so eventually the water heats up. The water starts boiling, starts bubbling. And that's samadhi. It's usually translated as concentration. I don't like the word concentration so much because in a way concentration has this quality of forcing something into a small space, you know, it's like concentrated or concentrated orange juice or something. Or, you know, someone saying, you need to concentrate. You know, something is like, so we use words like unifying. This is unifying the mind. This is gathering the mind, stabilizing the mind, steadying, stilling the mind. One of my Zen teachers defines this as directly touching. You know, so samadhi is directly touching something, this continuous contact with something, continuous contact with the sensations of the breathing, or continuous contact with the body. You know, and there are a number of different styles of meditation. I think about it as three main styles. You know, there's either focus or awareness of one main object, like the breath, or this combination of working with the breath plus the breath as an anchor plus open awareness, you know, so the body, the breath, and then you open up, you know, or this third style, which is just opening to everything, kind of a choiceless awareness. And so samadhi, the quality of samadhi can apply to each of these styles. And so my favorite way of defining samadhi is as the quality of undistractedness. You know, we're undistracted by something. You know, so samadhi is the steadiness, the stability, which allows mindfulness to work. It's like if you have a microscope, you want that microscope to be on something stable and steady, like a table. You know, you wouldn't kind of, you know, just kind of hold it around, or, you know, when it's stable and it's steady, then you can look and see, and that's mindfulness. So does that make sense? You know, understanding how these two work together? So samadhi is the steadiness and stability which lets mindfulness work in a sustained way, deep way. I'm going to skip a few things in the interest of time. So as samadhi, as this quality of samadhi strengthens and deepens, the mind becomes more perceptive. Our mindfulness becomes sharper. It can see more. It's like, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, yeah, I'm here, I'm mindful, it's Monday, you know, I'm mindful, I'm here. And it's like, okay, that's, you know, that's one level of mindfulness. You know, another level of mindfulness is to be present for the beginning of a thought, or to be present for, you know, the subtle sensations in the body, the vibrations in the arms, and you know, something like that. The experience of samadhi can be incredibly calming and healing. This is where, you know, people start to feel like, oh, now I get, you know, now I understand why people meditate. You know, like this, ah, you know, this, it's beautiful, you know. Deeply restful, deeply pleasurable to let the mind rest, to let the thinking mind rest. The Buddha describes it as like wrapping yourself in the softest, coziest white blanket, you know, and just, you know, just sitting and just so still and so peaceful, and you know, and so this is samadhi. You know, and I think we know this, you know, we know how pleasurable it can be to be absorbed in an activity that we enjoy, you know, to lose ourselves in activity. You know, we see children doing this all the time. It's like, you know, just totally lose themselves and no self-consciousness at all. So samadhi is the supporting condition for insight to arise, for wisdom to arise, which is the fifth faculty. It's like samadhi is the spotlight that, you know, allows us to see things as they really are. And that's wisdom. So samadhi is the ground, and wisdom is what grows, you know, from the soil. I already talked about wisdom as this function of knowing what's skillful, what's useful. So in Dharma practice, wisdom is seeing things as they are. You know, it's seeing the impermanence. It's seeing the Four Noble Truths. You know, it's seeing how we create suffering for ourselves and how we can be free ourselves from that suffering. You know, again, wisdom or discernment, this is not something we do. You know, we just take care of the ground, you know, take care of the soil. So just to end and say, you know, so these are called the five faculties, the five innate potential capabilities we all have of faith, effort, mindfulness, samadhi, concentration, and wisdom. And so it said when we develop and cultivate and grow these, they transform. And then they're not called the five faculties anymore, they're called the five powers. You know, these are the powers that we have, that we can depend on. Can lead us to deep peace, you know, deep happiness. This is Bhikkhu Bodhi again. Born of humble origins in everyday functions of the mind, through the Dhamma, the five faculties acquire a transcendent destiny. When they are developed and regularly cultivated, says the Buddha, they lead to the deathless, are bound for the deathless, and culminate in the deathless. So I wish for you, for all of us, that we appreciate this beautiful gift that we all have inside of these five abilities, capacities within our own hearts and minds, and use them for our own benefit and the benefit of all beings.